Thank you, John. I think it was Adlai Stevenson who once said, "Flattery is marvelous, provided you don't inhale." Shortly before the elections, Thomas Hughes, president of the Carnegie Endowment, claimed that some of us have been converting conservative biases into other people's perceptions about U.S. strategic vulnerabilities and lack of political leadership, and then confidently asserting our views about what the United States is all about. Well, Mr. Hughes and many others like him, particularly in the media, were wrong. I don't know of a single head of government or head of state or head of intelligence service in the Western world who did not feel that this was the most critical election in the United States since the end of World War II, and that 4 more years of Jimmy Carter would have been an unmitigated disaster for the Western world. While I agree, that a defense buildup cannot be substituted for a foreign policy, the liberals, as proved by the electorate, were wrong to dismiss the new team's pronouncements as mythology, petulance, false pride, and nostalgia. Concern over Soviet expansionism, over loss of U.S. credibility, and support for a stronger defense posture does not translate into truculent nationalism. In a recent national opinion poll in Western Germany, 60% of the people thought that another world conflict had become a real possibility. And only 8% of the people, if you'd asked for my rough guess, I would have said it was 50%, but only 8% of the people still shared a strong conviction that when the chips are down, they can rely on the U.S. as the world's only countervailing power. And 50% of the people felt that West Germany should begin moving to a position equidistant between the two superpowers. In the closing weeks of the campaign, West Germany, as you know, was already foregoing its NATO pledge to increase defense spending in real terms by 3% a year, and Belgium, Holland, and Denmark are drifting off in the same direction. A year and a half ago, I think the story can now be told, Chancellor Schmidt, on the west coast of this country, at the Bohemian Grove meeting, said, "Give us 4 more years of Carter, and West Germany will be a neutralized nation, and even if I'm reelected chancellor, which he was last month, I will not be able to prevent it." Allied leaders felt, and I have been privileged to share their confidences, they felt that Carter was strategically unaware, geopolitically ignorant, and diplomatically inept, and that the Carter Doctrine was ill thought through and hastily patched together from a position of weakness after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and was primarily inspired by presidential campaign considerations. All, without exception, all friendly leaders consider our decision-making process, as evidenced by the blunders of the last 4 years, to be a major security risk for their own future. And they feel that the strategic crisis of the 1980s was one that Jimmy Carter brought upon the Western world. No, our nation did not feel safer with President Carter after all. I think the whole nation felt, as the hostages did, with fresh evidence accumulating daily, that we were being held captive by forces we didn't even know how to influence, let alone control. That we had lost our sense of perspective, our sense of orientation, our sense of destiny. And personally, I have never seen a more dramatic illustration of our impotence than the current war between Iraq and Iran, with the Soviet Union gradually emerging, keeping one foot in both camps, gradually emerging as the arbiter of conflict in an area that is critically important to all of our futures. After 4 years of Jimmy Carter, friends and allies appear to have forgotten that there is nothing inevitable about history, as the Russians would have us believe. History is neutral, to be shaped by political and military leaders, not by media stars and pollsters. But there is a growing loss of nerve among Western democracies, which I am deeply convinced stems from a military inferiority complex vis-a-vis the Soviets. The stakes in the next few months, and let's not kid ourselves about this, are nothing short of the de facto neutralization of Western Europe and a rebirth of isolationism in this country. Henri Simonet, a former Belgian socialist foreign minister and a candidate to succeed Joseph Luntz as Secretary General of NATO, recently decried neutralism all over Europe. The British Labour Party, as you know, has not only adopted a platform that calls for unilateral nuclear disarmament, but has elected Michael Foot, a left-wing radical, as its leader, defeating the moderate Atlantic-oriented Denis Healey. Conditioned reflexes of appeasement are rampant all over Europe today, and I do live on that continent. It's what the French press has been calling for months, disalignment. But the next step could easily be sleepwalking into non-alignment. And the U.S. relationship with Western Europe will be Governor Reagan's biggest foreign policy challenge, without any question. On the night of his appointment, on December 5th, 1976, Cyrus Vance told me in his very first interview that one of his first priorities would be to try to redefine détente with the Soviet Union and make it global in scope. Because, he explained, if it's going to remain confined to the two Europes, it will be a sham and no real détente. Well, that turned out to be another major non-event under this administration. When Reagan talks about linkage, that is precisely what he means, no more and no less. An administration that can claim, as it has over and over again, as Dr. Brzezinski repeated on the Today Show this morning, that it has actually rejuvenated a weak and dispirited NATO alliance, raises very grave doubts indeed about its grasp of reality. In many of the conversations I had with statesmen and stateswomen or statespersons, I heard the warning time and again, and many of those interviews were published in Newsweek, including some of them with third world socialist hardliners, that the confusion, incoherence, and flip-flops, and U-turns, and O-turns, and zigzags, and poor crisis management, and unmet geopolitical challenges that had become associated with this administration's foreign policy could only lead to disaster. Our electorate understood, even if some of our pundits did not, that we are sliding toward a world out of control, with our relative military power continuing to decline, and with the Western world's economic lifeline increasingly vulnerable to blackmail, and with hostile radical forces still growing on every continent, in many cases encouraged by populist influences inside the Carter administration. The populists that Mr. Carter put into key positions shared a belief that military power had become increasingly irrelevant to their unorthodox views about how diplomacy should be practiced in the settlement of international disputes. Strategic superiority was decried as meaningless. Détente demanded drastic retrenchment of U.S. forces, a generous opening of advanced technology to communist countries, along, of course, with more credits, and a redirection of U.S. strategic emphasis from the East-West conflict to the search for meeting the bottomless demands of the radical regimes of the Third World. Then came the rude awakening of the results of the Jamaican elections, a major turning point, the defeat of Castro's and Carter's good friend, Michael Manley, without any encouragement from the United States. Third World radicalism simply cannot be tempered by a more generous and understanding U.S. posture, because the radicals of the Third World, and I know them well, object to our very existence, to our capitalist social structure, far more than they do to our foreign policy. And the closer we try to move to them, of course, the more they feel compelled to distance themselves from us, if only to maintain their revolutionary credentials. We have placated with humble apologies the most absurd accusations and met radical demands with abject concessions. And this was the sort of appeasement that led the bloc of so-called non-aligned nations to accept Fidel Castro as their chairman for 3 years. I have learned during 34 years of journalism, and most of that time as a foreign correspondent, that Soviet leaders are not impulsive people. They have made very shrewd power political calculations, and they are now trying to maximize the advantages that the changed balance of military power in the world confers on the men in the Kremlin, and which they cannot gamble will last forever. I don't think I'm telling you anything that you don't know when I say that the Soviets spent 20 years building up to this present point, and that through the 1970s, they earmarked three times as much as we did for defense, and in 79 alone, outspent this country by 50%. I think it was Pat Monahan who said a few months ago that the notion that the Soviets have surpassed the U.S. militarily has gone from total heresy to respectability, if not orthodoxy, in less than 3 years. Not since the 1930s have Western nations accepted so passively such a drastic shift in the balance of power. And Europe's reactions of continued détente at almost any cost would seem to indicate, to me at least, that Soviet leaders have calculated correctly. There is not one national intelligence director in Europe today, in Western Europe, who does not believe that we will face a period of maximum danger over the next 5 years as the relative military balance continues to shift against this country, and while a cycle of third world revolutions plays itself out, it will witness what just happened in Jamaica. But during that period, there is no question that Soviet leaders, either the tired old men now in the Kremlin or their successors already in their mid-60s, that these people may be very tempted to unite on a single set of objectives, secure a favorable international environment quickly and brutally, before facing their own domestic economic reassessment, as face it, they must. Rough strategic equivalence, a euphemism, as you know, for growing Soviet nuclear superiority, means an increasingly dangerous world, in which conventional weaponry and foreign bases and economic resources and secure air and sea lanes to protect our supply lines become absolutely vital to Western security. Many of us appear to have very faulty memories with near zero feedback. Perhaps we have forgotten that Mr. Brezhnev told his Warsaw Pact colleagues in April of 73, a meeting that had been penetrated by a British agent in the form of a high-ranking East European official who subsequently defected to the United Kingdom, quoting Mr. Brezhnev, "Peaceful coexistence and the current development of our new weapon systems are designed to achieve global military supremacy by 1985, by which time," he went on to explain, "the forces of world socialism will be in a position to dictate their will to the remnants of capitalist power in the Western world." So where was the moderation that the McNamaras and Kennans thought they had detected? But liberal intellectuals laughed a few of us out of court for repeating these warnings, for writing about them. We were told that this was empty communist rhetoric, and editors spiked, hence the title of our book, The Spike, spiked stories, kill stories that did not fit these naive perceptions of a Soviet Union evolving into a live and let live accommodation with the United States. The populists, I'm sure you all remember, denounced the arrogance of power. They said we would be a lot better off weak or weaker. Well, here we are, a lot weaker. And as I look back again on 34 years of journalism, it's very hard to escape the conclusion that the peace of the world was never more secure than when the United States was most powerful. One of the most spectacular privileges enjoyed by some of my colleagues is that they are always free to demonstrate scandalous stupidity without ever jeopardizing their reputations. Those who worshipped at Stalin's feet in the 20s and 30s have kept their reputations intact, and they have found very worthy successes. Remember how we all canonized Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh and Pham Van Dong and General Giap. We've already forgotten, I'm sure, that Andy Young was even suggesting that the Ayatollah himself might be worthy of canonization as a saint. I wonder how many of you know this, because this story, to my knowledge, did not cross the Atlantic. The former Communist Minister of Justice of the South Vietnamese National Liberation Front escaped among the boat people. And he said, and I quote, "Compared to the tyrants who rule us today, former President Thieu of South Vietnam, once described in your media as a fascist American puppet, was an enlightened liberal." Pacifism, neutralism, and radicalism have merged into populist perceptions that have led us astray time and again. We know from Soviet defectors that Moscow has long since concluded that the de facto neutralization of Western Europe is already well underway. After all, détente, their definition of détente, has survived some very important turning points in post-World War II history. Just a few examples. In 75, the introduction of Cuban proxy troops into Africa. In 77, a massive Soviet air and sea lift into the Horn of Africa, 10 days after that famous Begin Sadat summit meeting in Jerusalem, pouring over $1 billion worth of equipment into Ethiopia in a six-week period. Their detente survived a Soviet-assisted Marxist coup in Afghanistan in April of 78, followed immediately by the building of three Soviet military bases in Shindan, Kandahar, and Bagram, which of course put Soviet power to within 350 miles of the eastern shore of the Strait of Hormuz. And détente survived a very little noticed but terribly important pact between South Yemen, the only Marxist state in the Arab world, and the Soviet Union, exactly 13 months ago, whose military clauses went further than anything the Soviet Union has signed with any Arab country since the end of World War II. Also called for the building of three new military bases with extraterritorial privileges and for an increase in the East German, Cuban, and Soviet military advisory groups from 3,000 to 20,000 in a 12-month period, which expired a month ago. And I checked with some of my intelligence sources in Western Europe just a few days ago. They say the figure is now 18,000. I haven't seen that anywhere in this country. So why shouldn't détente, their détente, survive what has already been or has been minimized for some months now by Soviet disinformation as a minor police action in Afghanistan? I think one has to be irredeemably myopic not to see that the Soviets have been maneuvering their proxies by the projection of their global power, which, as you all know, has increased roughly eightfold in the last 10 years, while our own has steadily declined in the very areas upon which our allies depend for their survival. For this book, which you kindly alluded to, The Spike, and thanks for the plug, Robert Moss and I had access to some 25 defectors from the KGB, the GRU, and other Eastern Secret Services. And to a man, I'm sorry, ladies, there wasn't one Mata Hari in the group, but to a man, they have all told us the same thing. And that is that Soviet disinformation has time and again successfully anesthetized Western opinion makers and Western governments. The media, as I've watched it evolve in recent years, has become a very powerful instrument of illusion in defiance of basic political and geopolitical and historical realities. No reason why you should have read this, it hasn't been translated yet. But a former high-ranking member of the French Communist Party, Auguste Lecoeur, expelled from the party for having denounced the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 68, recently published a book in France titled La Stratégie du Mensonge, The Strategy of Lies. He said everything we did, our whole raison d'être, was a lie. Well, what he's written about in the French context, we have tried to explain in an international context through our book, The Spike. Perhaps it's worth remembering, because again, memories are short, a letter that Dr. Andrei Sakharov, and we're not talking about Mr. Solzhenitsyn, we're talking about a man who is still a hero to every liberal in the Western world, who invented the Soviet H-bomb, who had every door to the Kremlin open to him for 25 years before he became Russia's leading dissident, now in KGB-imposed exile in the city of Gorky, who smuggles out a letter to the New York Times, which, to the eternal credit of Edward Klein, the editor of the Sunday New York Times magazine, was published as the cover story of their June 8th issue, and which warns in no uncertain terms about four categories of agents of influence busily promoting Soviet interests and Soviet objectives inside our Western societies, but particularly inside my profession. Very quickly, you know he's talking about, number one, as he explains it, the ideologically motivated, motivations that are worthy of discussion. But number two, he says, there are the people who call themselves progressive because they consider it fashionable or prestigious or financially rewarding or, which is always very convenient, all three. Number three, he says, there are naive, poorly informed, indifferent people who close their eyes and ears to the bitter truth and eagerly swallow any sweet lie, provided that it is appropriately sugar-coated with disarmament proposals and peace offensives. And number four, he says, the most important category, people who have been bought, B-O-U-G-H-T, in the most direct sense of that word. And here he says, I'm referring to businessmen, a great many writers, a great many journalists, government advisors, even heads of press and television. Well, that is a devastating indictment. And it was carefully spiked, because I was in Europe shortly after that came out, and nobody seemed to be aware of it. The wire services carried certain passages, but not the passages that I have just quoted. Sakharov also told us not to reject allegations about links between the KGB and international terrorist organizations. But of course, if our leaders face up to these links, they have to face up to what détente is all about, and that they will not do. The world, says Sakharov, is facing very critical times and cruel cataclysms because the West and developing countries do not show the required firmness, unity, and consistency in resisting this totalitarian challenge. And this, he says, relates to governments, to the intelligentsia, to the media, to big business. And it is critically important that the common danger be fully understood, and then, he says, everything else will fall into place. And I happen to agree with this, because we simply have to get the diagnosis right before we can begin to come up with the appropriate remedies. It is not simply a question of throwing money at the defense budget. The dangers our friends and allies have seen it for the last 3 years stem from the erroneous perceptions of this administration, and I don't have to recall what they were. But very briefly, unilateral restraint in the development of new weapon systems, unreciprocated concessions, turn-the-other-cheek diplomacy, unmet geopolitical challenges, and of course a greater emphasis on human rights policies, and that somehow this huge ball of wax, if thrown at the Kremlin, would strike a responsive chord. Well, it struck a responsive chord, all right, but not quite the one that Mr. Carter had anticipated. And the most important question of all was not even addressed in our presidential debates and campaign. And that is the fact that the West has not been using its overwhelming economic might to balance Russia's overwhelming military power, but to support it. Because today we are in effect funding two defense budgets, our own and theirs. Technology transfers have become very big business indeed. Credits from West to East have now gone over the $100 billion mark. I thought it was 75, but the Wall Street Journal corrected me 3 weeks ago. And the new military trucks that I saw in Afghanistan and those APC engines that I saw Soviet soldiers tinkering with in 20 degree below zero weather had come out of the Kama River plant in the Urals, built with 132 US licenses, not to mention scores of other licenses from Japan and Western Europe. We didn't invent this. Soviet officers who arrested us for getting too close to their positions were proud to tell us where these things had been made. They even said these are the best trucks ever made in the Soviet Union. In my judgment, that there is no way they could continue to spend from 13 to 15% of their GNP on the military, given their massive economic problems, without this kind of Western assistance. Businessmen have no desire to make any kind of sacrifice to deter future Afghanistans. And the now 10-month-old Soviet peace offensive in Western Europe is clearly designed to reinforce the reluctance of European leaders to face up to these rather unpleasant facts. Diplomatically, economically, militarily, Western Europe is demonstrating almost daily that it believes, at least subconsciously, that Soviet global military power is becoming increasingly relevant and our own military power increasingly irrelevant to their future cares and concerns. Some strategists, as you know, see events pushing the United States irreversibly into a new kind of power role that would somehow engage Britain and some of the other continental allies into a new strategy for the defense of Western interests outside of the NATO area. But so far, as you know, the new so-called Carter Doctrine has done very little to restore confidence among Western Europe's policy planners and policy makers. The immediate threat, as you all know, is not a Soviet takeover of the oil fields, which Mr. Carter has pledged to defend against external aggression, but to the remaining pro-Western regimes on the Arab side of the Persian Gulf. The new doctrine, moreover, is utterly useless against a Marxist takeover, for example, in Tehran tomorrow afternoon. If Mr. Reagan wants to persuade the Allies that they should pursue a new policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, he is going to have to come up with very clear, precise concepts, both short-term and long-term. Some of the key gut questions. Should the West, for example, concede that NATO, with an obsolete strategy, has been overtaken by events, and that the alliance as a whole, or in part, should now declare that the Gulf is an essential Western interest, not simply an American one? And doesn't such a policy presuppose an overall Middle Eastern settlement as quickly as possible, that is, a solution to the Palestinian problem without, of course, facilitating the creation of another Cuba or another Nicaragua under PLO leadership on the West Bank? Hasn't the time come for the Allies to pull together their not insignificant leverage on the economic side and compel the Soviet Union not into a mindless arms race, but into a veritable reversal of the arms race by driving hard-nosed geopolitical bargains with this not insignificant economic leverage? And if the Soviet Union won't listen because they feel that the Europeans are too scared or too weak or irrevocably hooked on East-West trade, shouldn't the alliance then as a whole, or in part, begin to shed its inhibitions about giving the Soviets a dose of their own medicine? And by that I mean supporting a new phenomenon, the growing anti-Marxist national liberation fronts in areas where Marxist regimes have been imposed by force since our defeat in Vietnam, and you know them by heart. With a little political will at the top and real material and medical assistance to the Afghan resistance movement, which we have betrayed, Afghanistan could indeed become Russia's Vietnam and begin to reverse the tide of expansionism, or at least give very serious pause for thought to the next generation of Soviet leaders. This would throw back at the Soviets the case they made for helping North Vietnam during the war. How to restore backbone and consistency and continuity to U.S. foreign policy is, of course, as we all know, the key. How do we do this? Clearly, all like-minded nations have to pitch in because demands for American security support are likely to exceed, if they haven't exceeded already, our own capabilities. Shouldn't we be exploring, as some of our strategists have been suggesting, a new Athenian League, an All Oceans Alliance, at the very least, a three ocean navy for the United States. And last but not least, a new North-South partnership with our advanced technology as the ultimate trump card. There is, of course, as you all know, an alternative to all of this, as I think it was our friend Norman Podhoretz who expressed it so well recently. There is an alternative to all of this, and that is a cynical retreat from crisis. But if we persist in adopting the ungainly posture of the proverbial ostrich, we shouldn't be surprised if we get kicked in the most obvious place. We may have a very nutty political system in my adopted country, but our society has enormous underlying strength. America remains the most dynamic society in the world. There is nothing we can't do if we don't set our minds to it. And I feel, having covered 90 countries in this world, that American influence must grow, not shrink. And I am firmly convinced that the people who voted for Governor Reagan on November 4 intended one hell of a lot more than a repudiation of a failed presidency. Thank you for your patience.